In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
The Jack Welch Management Institute at Strayer University helps you go from, I know the way, to I've arrived with our top 10 ranked online MBA. Gain skills you can learn today and apply tomorrow. Get ready to go from make it happen to made it happen and keep striving. Visit strayer.edu/Jack Welch MBA to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV and has many campuses, including at 2121 15th Street North in Arlington, Virginia.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail. Companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of my podcast this week is Matt Acharya, co-founder and co-CEO of Clay.
Be very clear about the values and the lines that you will cross and won't cross. Because I think when things start speeding up and momentum is something very precious, when you move really fast, you have to move with confidence. And if you don't have that confidence and that foundation, you're not going to be able to make decisions rapidly.
This is Matt. He has a diverse background in product development and design. He was a principal at design agency 46, working with clients like Disney, BBC, Expedia, and the University of Pennsylvania. And then he held product roles at Coursera, which was later acquired by Amperity, and LayerVault, which was later acquired by Tiny Capital. He has a lifelong obsession with the craft of design, sparked by childhood curiosity why certain objects elicit the feeling of joy. This led him to question the status quo of relationship management software, and that's how the vision behind Clay was born. In 2018, he and his co-founder Zach Hamed founded the company, an app for managing personal and professional relationships, and their mission? To help people be more thoughtful and helpful with their relationships, ultimately helping them to achieve more and be happier by putting others first. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Matt to my podcast. We explore his journey of building Clay. He shares how he and his team create meaningful differentiation beyond just solid functionality. He elaborates how they gained early traction and how they created strong organic growth that enabled them to now manage well over 100 million relationships. Last but not least, Matt shares his insights on navigating trade-offs, maintaining confidence in decision-making, and staying true to the company's values while scaling rapidly. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, his unconventional approach towards creating a minimum remarkable product instead of a minimum viable product. Secondly, how they strengthen their differentiation by focusing on things other than just functionality, and where he focuses to find his inspiration. Thirdly, how they've managed to achieve all their growth to be entirely organic and driven by word of mouth. And lastly, what signals, in hindsight, he wishes he had paid more attention to in order to grow even more. Well, hi, Matt. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Of course. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
Well, there's another one here on this side. Because, that's the story that I'll share in a minute. But thank you for making the time. I got inspired by one of your comments on LinkedIn that was talking about your philosophy around building initially minimum remarkable products. And of course, since I wrote a book about the remarkable effect, that triggers me. So that's how our conversation got started. Then I started using your app. I loved it from minute one. I can recommend it to everybody. But before we start talking about your company called Clay, very fascinating name, what drives you? What do you get energy from?
Thank you. The thing that drives me the most is actually, I would say, it doesn't come from a place of good feelings. I get really annoyed with something. And when I get annoyed with something, I pay very close attention to it, whether or not I want to. And so I would say annoyances is a big driving force. And I think the second thing, if you want to frame it in a more positive way, I really enjoy making stuff. And I think what really got me into tech was enjoying craft, enjoying the act of building something for the sake of building it and not so much for the output. And those two things pretty much fuel the entirety of what I do, I would say.
Nice. Yeah. Now you can definitely see the craft part in the app. It is beautiful how it's done. And I get the point about annoyed. I think I have something in myself as well that gets some of the things going that I focus on. So making then the connection to your app, to your company. You started this company in 2018, so it's 6 years down the road right now. What was the big problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution like you are developing here?
Yeah, so we started thinking about it in 2018 and ideating. I wouldn't say we really kicked it off until the end of 2019, 2020. And it was a slow burn, I think, that came from a place of frustration around the current state of relationship tooling. And what we saw was two different things. We saw these massive sales tools that were super transactional. And on the other end of the spectrum, we had contacts apps that really hadn't evolved, you know, as long as I've been alive. And we wanted something a little better. And truthfully, it came from this feeling that a lot of the great things in my life really came from other relationships. And my co-founder, Zach, felt the same way. And we bonded over that, actually. And we said, why isn't there a tool to protect, to care for, to nurture one of the most important things in our lives, which was relationships? And that was the thread that we just kept pulling on. And, you know, it led us through a lot of different places, which ended up in Clay.
Cool. How did you end up with the name? And I mean, of your website is actually even more specific. It's clay.earth.
Yeah. So the .earth domain was something that was interesting. There was a new TLD at the time, and we wanted to differentiate ourselves. I think the ultimate thing was like, we just really wanted something, a word that was really grounded and could take on meaning that people wanted to imbue to it. And so we felt that represented how we think about relationships. It's something that's always being molded, almost being formed. And it kind of stuck, and we really loved it. We went through a whole bunch of other names, which I won't go into now, but that is the one that really felt most true to what we were feeling at that time, which is a very deeply human value.
Exactly. I mean, you already mentioned two words that are super important, like meaning and differentiate. Yeah, I mean, in the world of tech these days, where it's so easy, easy between air quotes, but it becomes so easy to create pretty sophisticated applications. And the release of that is, of course, just increasing every single day. I mean, in my book, The Remarkable Effect, I already talk about the things like the half-life of a product. When I was creating these applications in the ERP space, the half-life of the product was possibly 5, 6, 7 years. These days, of course, it's a fraction of that. So differentiate is a very important point. In relation to that thing then, you said 2018 we started, 2020 we actually got started to activate it. What did you do in the beginning then to create something that was differentiating from the start?
Yeah, and a bunch of things. And I think the way it really started is we start by trying to disprove an idea rather than trying to prove it. I think you can always find supporting arguments for anything that you want to do. And so we said, let's try and kill this thing. Let's try and get it out of our heads. And that for us was basically two things. It was just talking to a ton of people about how they thought about the problem and what tools they were using. And it started with our friends, you know, family, colleagues, but then it sort of spread outwards from there. And that sort of gave us pause because everyone was saying, articulating that problem, but in different ways, right? So if you talk to someone in finance, they're like, yeah, I don't know how to manage relationships, so I'm using Excel. Or if you talk to someone, you know, who's a writer, they're like, I'm using my note-taking app to keep track of relationships. And they were all doing this practice, but they were doing it in the tool of the trade rather than a tool that was dedicated to it. And so we kept hearing that over and over again, which got us excited. And so my co-founder and I are both technical and designers. And so we were able to build a prototype out of that and to see if anyone else wanted it. And so that kept snowballing, which eventually led to us talking to a lot of folks in the productivity, tooling, CRM, relationship space, just understanding what went right, but also importantly, talking to companies that failed, right? Or that got acquired or shut down and what went wrong. And so between all those things, it gave us the confidence to put something together in that initial version of Clay, which we then tested, and it sort of took off. We wrote a tweet thread about it that sort of took off, and it was basically our thoughts or a summary of the research that we had done and how we thought about the problem. And it clearly hit a nerve with a group of folks, and we were off to the races from that.
Yeah, you were already ticking a number of boxes that I also talk about in my book. But I really like that idea of disproving the idea, because like you say, it's so easy to kind of get approval for the idea and people just nodding and being polite. No, kill it. Try to kill it. And if you can't kill it, there's something behind it. Exactly. People start talking to you and say, no, don't kill this. This is crazy. And how you think about the solving the problem. I think that's another very important angle that not too many companies do. Having a different perspective about the approach of solving the problem rather than, that already kind of gets you in a different way. It's about almost the art of category creators that they use there. Fascinating. The product came about. It took off. What has been one of the hardest nut to crack to cut through the noise, so to say, because not everybody, of course, knows about this.
Yes.
Everybody has been doing their own thing.
Exactly. And I think that still is the problem. Like, you know, every day we wake up and we still feel like we've only touched 1%. And that's due to a multitude of factors, right? Yeah. And I think to your point about durability earlier, there's this Bezos quote that says, like, you know, one of the founding sort of tenets around Amazon is that customers are never not going to want cheaper prices, right? And I think humans are not going to ever have relationships. And we think it's a very durable space. But that being said, there's a lot of competition. And so the ways that we tried to differentiate was basically thinking about where other companies went wrong. And the first thing was around privacy. We think of privacy as a gradient, basically. On the right side of the spectrum, you have people who are super privacy conscious and lock everything down. And on the left side, you have people who don't care and just trade, you know, whatever information for any kind of utility. And so we said we had to find that balance, and you do that by trust. And it took a while to figure out the right balance between utility and privacy. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if someone trusts you, they're willing to give you their data in exchange for something else. And you have to take that with a lot of care. So we made that at the forefront of all our UI decisions, all our privacy policy, and you know, every sort of product, every iteration starts with that question of like, is this something that feels right from building a trust with your customer? And I think that was the starting point. And then the second big differentiator, I think, is just showing that we care. Again, this shows itself in really good design fundamentals, but I really believe it's in like every step of the process, from the language that we use. Like, you know, we try not to use certain words. We try not to use certain language that disrespects relationships, or we think like, you know, it doesn't feel right. We try not to even use the word users, right? We gravitate towards members. And instead of contacts, we try relationships and people instead of, again, contacts. So we use all these different words. And I think that comes across as this tool or the service or this platform really cares. And it should be a great home for my relationships.
Yeah, exactly. What have you done so far? I mean, talking about that comment that you gave about minimum remarkable product or remarkable products, mm-hmm. What is your philosophy around that in terms of your day-to-day decisions that you take around what goes into the product and then how you develop it? Have you sort of got a certain framework for that to test things, whether they are the immediate bar?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it starts with a matter of taste. And I think anyone can cultivate taste. It's not this like, you know, highbrow thing that people are born with. It's sort of identifying the best things in whatever field or whatever product that you're looking at and trying to really tease out what the commonalities and principles are and then applying it to your own work. And it takes many years and it's hard, which is why it's rare, but it's definitely a teachable trait. And for us was that having, you know, loved apps and software and grown up with some really great inspiration in the art of software, we knew that there were tenets and values that these companies had that we would want to emulate. And so that informed our basis for what a minimum remarkable product is. Yeah. And so I think it comes from having a really high bar and thinking about not generally like, you know, just not just copying what they're doing, but understanding the values and processes that those companies, those services went through to get to the output that we want.
Exactly. What I see, of course, a lot is there's always scarcity of people. There's no time. Mm-hmm. There's always a kind of a pressure to do things. And as a consequence, we settle for, okay, it's good enough.
Right.
But why do you then still go at length to create something that people will start talking about? I mean, don't you have internally also that argument, okay, it is good enough?
To be fair, I don't think so. So I think there's a lot of stuff in the product today that we could improve. And I think it's, you know, a spectrum of iteration that you're constantly trying to improve yourself, especially with something like software that's a living product, right? You're constantly trying to iterate and improve. And so I don't think you ever reach that platonic ideal with it. That being said, you do have to make a ton of trade-offs. And I think I've gotten a little better with that over the years. When I first started, I would say, we held some things like pretty closely, and you know that caused a lot of time, a lot of effort and energy going to something that might not have necessarily been the best use of time. But we've learned to navigate those trade-offs now by basically trying. I think the main thing is time boxing things, because you can constantly iterate on something. So I think the tools around like setting very clear deadlines, and then articulating about truly what the problem is that we're trying to solve.
Let me make a small interruption here. Matt just made an excellent remark about the essence to build a remarkable product in a world that's just moving faster. Time box decisions and carefully articulate the problem that you try to solve. This, in combination with their approach to validating product ideas, i.e. to disapprove it rather than to trying to prove it, creates a very effective way to operate in a very lean way while being ultra effective. It is all about the art of focusing on the essence, a trait that remarkable software companies master. And with that, they funnel their curiosity in a very lean way, move fast, and iterate quickly to create something that's highly valuable and desirable. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
Right? Like what is the major thing? And then everything else sort of feeds up into it. And so we've had to make some trade-offs there with certain product decisions and things. But, and then also having the notion that you can come back to it, right? Like you can come back to it and make it really great. And then understanding it's always also a constant balance between what you think is great and what your audience thinks is great. And so for us, sometimes when we're competing with a tool like Salesforce, our design values and our craft is so far ahead of products like that, it's not worth investing in that resource because the status quo is so low. So again, it's like this, I would imagine like this sort of three-sided problem between like what your customers want and what's in the market versus what you're feeling and then versus what the product actually is today. And so you're constantly like managing those sliders or moving those things back and forth to get the right balance.
True. And I mean, it wouldn't even come up to me that this is something that would even compete with Salesforce because it is indeed not comparable.
thank you. Yeah.
So yeah, going to market then, what was the journey like? I mean, the question at the end is like, what is this, a B2B product? Is it a B2C product? Because I mean, I, yeah, I'm using it as a solo entrepreneur, and I can imagine that a lot of people are using it in that perspective. Where do you see your market?
Yeah, so we have a couple different personas, and that's evolved. I think we started the original persona is always, you know, I think it starts in a place of your own wanting or own needs. There was us, which was like seeking a less intense, all-encompassing tool like a CRM, but then needing something more than an address book. So we play in that in-between space. Some people define us as a prosumer. That feels like the right category for us, which is you really care about your relationships or you really care about your network and you need something to manage that. And we believe that market is like massive, right? So we sign up so many interesting customers through that vertical. And I think the way we think about that is like, we're only trying to solve three problems, which is who do I know? Basically, the breadth of your network. How well do I know them? And then how can I deepen those relationships? So that pretty much answers the entirety of all relationship questions in our mind. And we then just apply that to all these different verticals. But I would say prosumer is the category if you're looking for a single word or single definition.
Yeah, exactly. Because you can use it like in a standalone version. And of course, I can imagine that the moment you start to bring your team on board and the rest of the company, it becomes even more powerful because of the relationships we have between each other. But the question at the end is, okay, if that's the person where you will get most traction because you deliver most value. Because I've been in the product management and product marketing space. Mm-hmm. It's so hard to address the needs of different type of personas. And so where do you make the choices? Because the company, of course, is also, your company, I'm not sure how many people you currently have employed, but it's not going to be the end of the world. You have to make choices there as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Again, a set of trade-offs that you have to. We lose certain vertical specific things by going broad, right? But it's a conscious choice that we make. I'm not saying that's not like, there's successful examples on either side of that spectrum, or at least I think so.
Yeah. Do you ever imagine that this product will go from product-led to a more of a sales-led motion?
So it's super interesting. We were talking about that today. So we recently launched our first foray into our Teams product, and that was all based on, we had looked at a bunch of these accounts, and we saw there's a feature that we have called delegated access when we were only supporting one person, which was basically if you have an EA or if you have someone else that you just want to be on your account, you can go in and add those folks. Then it's, you know, view only mode. But what we saw hundreds of companies trying to hack this feature to essentially use Clay as their CRM. And so we started pulling on that thread and started talking to all those people, basically what we did a few years ago. And we found out that there's a large swath of companies that don't care or don't want to use a CRM or don't want to invest the resources into it. And so there was enough value in Clay that was driving that for their personal lives. They were trying to bring that into their companies. And so they said, like, cool, like, let's add that. And so we said, let's take that feature and promote it and call it Teams and like actually like support workflows around that. And so that became the basis of our Teams product. So to answer your question in a roundabout way, no sales focus yet. It's all entirely someone identifying Clay in their own life and then like trying to bring it into their work life or vice versa.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And then if that's going by word of mouth, like why should you start a sales motion on that? Possibly it's only going to be when you really start to hit the bigger accounts. Talking about the getting traction then, can you explain the journey to get to your first 100, possibly 1,000 customers? What was the biggest learning in that space?
Right. So that I earlier mentioned the tweet that my co-founder Zach and I authored to share. And I think that was, it was basically a landing page with three of our values, and then the prototype that we had built, a video recording the prototype, and then a sign-up form. And I think from that alone, and we wanted to gauge intent, so we had a credit card flow. So you not only was it a sign-up, but if you really wanted it, you had to put down your credit card. We didn't charge the card, but it was just an idea of saying like, hey, there's some dollar value expressed in wanting this thing. Yeah. And so we said, let's try this experiment. And from that, I think it drove over the course of like a week or 2 weeks, 10 to 12,000 signups right out of the gate. So that was the starting point. And from there, we just kind of snowballed. And so all our growth today is organic. We're starting to think about like SEO and a few other like channels, but it's all entirely word of mouth.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can imagine that because the app is, I mean, I've been talking about the app to a number of people already. So this is the proof point of it.
Thank you. Yeah.
12,000 users, a couple of days. I mean, how do you then keep that momentum going if it's purely organic because you didn't do anything on paid? Was there anything you did to kind of stir up that momentum?
Yeah, so I mean, we have a pretty active social media presence on Twitter. We try to talk about relationships as much as we can. I think a lot of our current growth now is, you know, we think about email as a very important channel for us. Like, it's how we communicate with our customers. And so we put a lot of emphasis and thought into our product releases. We try to be explain things really well. We try to have really beautiful graphics. And so any kind of communication that we have with our customers is growth, right? Because it's a touch point, whether it's like a support message or the way we message a feature, it's all to us marketing. And so I think at this point, that I would say is where we spend our most time. We've tried some paid experiments, but it's just a game that we don't really want to play, or at least we've seen how that plays out at scale, and it requires a level of investment that we don't really care for. That being said, as you know, knock on wood, if organic growth peters out at some point, we will explore different channels. I think the thing that we're excited about today is more around SEO. So sort of having domain authority around content and, you know, profiles and presence on the internet. And so that gives you a lot of different opportunities for growth. And so we're investing in that today.
Sure.
And then,
yeah. I didn't catch that from my research, but have you got funding in the business?
Yes. Yeah. So we raised to date a little over $9 million from a set of really great investors, with the main investors being General Catalyst, invested in like Stripe and Airbnb and those companies, and Forerunner, who's invested in a bunch of great companies like Glossier and Chime and stuff like that. And we have a really fantastic set of angels too, which in some ways is really a blessing because we get to rely on that, on their advice.
Exactly. At what point did you get the funding in?
I want to say we were working on that, throwing things back and forth for about like a year before we got serious. And then we both left our jobs and started working on ourselves. Like I said, it wasn't really until the point where we had that landing page and we really convinced ourselves there was something here that we wanted to raise any venture. And I think venture is a very deliberate decision. And having been both at failed startups, worked in failed startups and successful startups before, we didn't take that choice lightly. So,
would you do it again?
Take venture or start Clay?
No,
it's two very different questions.
The venture part, because I mean, at the end, of course, you got such a good product. The word of mouth is fantastic. People pay for the product and happily pay for the product. So I can also imagine that you'll pretty quickly get a reliable income stream whereby you can have that decision. Funding or not?
Yeah, I think to answer the question, it really depends on the shape of the company that you're taking. If we're thinking through the lens of Clay, I think it's a bit of a toss-up. It would just have taken a little slower for us to sort of marshal together the resources that we would need. And it's the classical dilemma that a lot of founders have between bootstrapping and you know, sort of raising money and all the strings that come attached with that. But we're pretty happy with that choice. And I think I would do it again. But again, it depends on the type of company that... There's the devil's in the details here with the nuance.
What would you change then? Now that you know what you know, what would you do different with the funding that... Well, maybe the moment, maybe the way you apply it. Is there anything different there?
Well, there's a ton of lessons. So we've been through several different, you know, sort of macroeconomic cycles. And I think the thing that I would have thought about differently was more about how internally in your business, nothing can change, but factors outside of your control dictate a lot of whether your ability to raise, your time in market. And so there's a lot of signals that I didn't quite understand, because in my mind, if things are always working internally, it should be pretty easy to have external markers of that, right? And it should be very obvious to everyone else. But the thing that you don't take into effect is that there's a whole big complicated ecosystem that happens outside of your company that dictates how people think about, you know, your space, your the things that you're doing. And so the things that I would change was like pay a little bit more attention to that and really understand what investors are looking for, what the macro is. And, you know, I think all this is with the benefit of hindsight. Like, we were like, the reason why we got into this is because we liked building stuff. And so we had to learn, like, I think maybe it was Reid Hoffman who says, like, you know, working on a startup is like jumping out of a plane and then trying to rebuild a plane, or jumping off a cliff and trying to rebuild a plane on the way down. And that's essentially what we had to do. We had to learn very quickly and adapt. And so,
yeah, exactly. Well, it's of course, funding always gives you sort of the parachute, because there's at least some money in the bank that you can rely on as you learn. Mm-hmm. But it's always interesting to learn about the different lessons and what you could possibly do different, because there's always some value in there. Looking at the time, well, you've actually in the meantime read my book, The Remarkable Effect. You're a big promoter of that as well. Do you have any frameworks in your company that you use to make the decisions that you take, product strategy wise, go to market wise? Well, let's start with product strategy wise. What you build and what you don't build.
Right.
And then in relation to standing out in the marketplace.
Right, and I think the first thing is we try to be a student of the market before trying to go into it. And what that really means is just like trying all the available tools out there. There's this really great graphic in design where the cycle someone goes through to create something, and you start really broad, right? So you take in every bit of content and everything related to the problem that you're trying to think about. So you might get inspiration from a movie, you know, for something that we might ship, or you might get something from a book. It doesn't matter. At that point, you're going really broad, and any idea sort of works. It's a very common idea in improv and a lot of creative circles where yes and, right? Like, and I think you start there, and then you sort of whittle. You whittle over time, and you create a compression. And then you have a slightly smaller list of ideas and things that you want to work on. And again, you go through that cycle of whittling. And eventually, at the outset of that process, which takes, you know, it can take years, it can take weeks, you have an essence of something that's kind of new, that's been informed by several cycles of basically going wide, expanding your horizon, trying to take in as many inputs as you can, and then compressing. And so a lot of our product is done that way. So we're shameless about like looking at consumer apps. We look at any kind of app for inspiration, and it doesn't matter if it's a good idea. And so we bring in a lot of stuff into Clay. And so you can see a lot of that in the UI, a lot of that in the way we think about features. So just because someone does, you know, a reminders function the way it's been done for the last 10 years, doesn't mean that that's the right thing to do. So I'm thankful that we have our folks in the team that think a lot about that, but I really enjoy doing that as well.
Trade number four, you know, remarkable software companies master the art of curiosity. That is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
Okay, last question then. Running the company for a couple of years right now, based on the lessons that you've learned, what would be a do? And what would be a don't that you'd like to share with, you know, aspiring tech entrepreneurs or people that want to take the company to the next level as well?
It's a great question. When you say next level, do you mean in terms of growth, expansion, like, or is it a very broad interpretation there?
No, I mean, it's imagine they are kind of, they've just hit their first million ARR, got product market fit, want to start scaling. What would you advise them in that realm?
I would say the thing to do is to be very clear about the values and the lines that you will cross and won't cross. Because I think when things start speeding up and momentum is something very precious, and once you have it, it's a great feeling within the company, but a lot of things can start breaking. So it's always helpful to have a reference or a foundation that you have of things that you will and won't do, right? And I think companies, things go really badly when you don't really understand who you are. Because I think when you move really fast, you have to move with confidence. And if you don't have that confidence and that foundation, you're not going to be able to make decisions rapidly. I think the thing I wouldn't do is, I think a lot of advice around move fast and break things is generally true, but I don't think that is the best thing for a lot of companies. You have to think about what kind of company you are. And again, I guess it just goes back to saying, like, have a good set of foundational values that you can rely on in tough times and in good times. That's the simplest way of saying that.
So you really have to kind of, yeah, you have to sit together with your management team or your co-founders before that happens.
And it's largely a personal choice, right? If you're, especially to this audience, it's a lot of founders. Like, people say, like, oh, cool, like, you know, let's look at the data, let's look at the metrics. But at the end of the day, you're driving that ship, and your company is in some way an expression of your values. And so it feels wrong to you. You need to have a gut check, because it all stems from that. And so it's a very personal decision. So I would take some time to process that carefully.
Okay. Very good advice. Well, thank you very much, Matt, to share the story about where you go with the company. I'll keep using the application because I loved it, how it helps me with the relationships that I nurture and want to keep and make flourish. Where can people go to find out more about the company, the product, or to say hi to you?
Perfect. And again, thank you for having me. This was a really fun conversation, really thoughtful questions. And again, I love your values. We try to live by your values. So that you've expressed both as a person and in your book. So thank you for that. You can find out more from us at clay.earth. And for me personally, I'm just at Acharyam, which is my last name, Acharyam, on most platforms. And yeah, feel free to send me an email, or I'm always looking to chat with interesting people.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much. And this ends my conversation with Matt, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Matt Acharyam, co-founder and co-CEO of Clay. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas. And that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the remarkable effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.